Let's begin today's episode with a quote from a Patrick McManus story. If you're not familiar with McManus, he has been, in my humble opinion, the best author of outdoor humor over the course of my lifetime. He's published a large number of books of his short and funny outdoor stories, and for decades, he had a regular column, first in Field and Stream, and then in Outdoor Life. This particular excerpt is from a story called Temporary Measures. In it, he talks about how so very many parts of a typical outdoor person's life is made up of temporary measures, including the one in this passage. I really do want to organize my tackle box. Several years ago, I fished with a man who actually had his tackle box organized. He expressed some disapproval of my technique of hauling out a cluster of lures and spinning it around until I found the one I wanted. Naturally, I was embarrassed and realized I had to do something to correct the situation. For a temporary measure, I didn't go fishing with that man anymore. Welcome to Bristol Bay Field Notes. I'm Terry Fuller, Education Specialist for Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. As I sat staring at my computer screen, debating various topics that might lend themselves to a Field Notes episode, I had a number of different ideas that, while each had some merit, fell short of having enough to develop into a full topic. As such, I decided today to take a bit of a buffet-style approach and go with some of those ideas, each as standalone topics. And the first, tied to my introduction, is to consider that February is almost over. It's a good time to consider getting your stuff ready for fishing season. I have several friends who prefer fishing over hunting, and they're already in countdown mode until the water is open and they can actively fish on a daily basis. Not me. Fishing's just something to do. Yes, it's fun, but a filler, really. In between the close of various hunting seasons and the opening of the same in the fall. For those who prefer fishing, now would be a great time to clean out and organize a tackle box, put new line on your reels, and take stock of what you need to purchase before summer gets here and it's too late. Don't find yourself in a situation where you have to duck a fishing buddy because of awkward embarrassment over the state of your tackle box. Of course, if you fish with the sorts of friends that I do, that's probably not going to be an issue anyway. With that, let's move on to other topics. Let's talk migratory birds. It's true, the 2018 Alaska Migratory Bird Calendar Contest did recently conclude, and entries from schools outside Dillingham are likely in the mail to our office, even as I tell you about that. But the reason I say let's talk migratory birds is because this winter, and it has been a winter to this point, joyously I might add, a handful of birds may have to give up their migratory species membership cards for failing to comply with the most basic tenet, that they migrate. A few folks in town have seen species during the last few months that are decidedly migratory species, though a few select individuals apparently decided that migrating was overrated and maybe winter wouldn't really be all that bad. I know of three people who have seen fox sparrows at their feeders this winter, two of whom got photos. And I have had a golden crown sparrow in my yard feeding, and he's been pretty darned regular every day since just before Christmas. If you're not familiar with either species, both eat seeds and such, but rely heavily on insects, which is why they're migratory. Golden crown sparrows are strictly a West Coast species. We have a lot of them around here in the summer, but typically, they blow town fairly early in the fall and make their way down the West Coast areas from southern British Columbia to Mexico. Fox sparrows migrate even greater distances, with most fox sparrows that summer in Alaska flying to wintering grounds in the southeast of the lower 48. In light of that, you can see why both species would seem a bit out of place here right now. I have to believe that some of the sub-zero temperatures that we've had over the last month look and feel a whole lot different than February in Southern California or Florida. Concerning the golden crown, who's been staying with us, he seems to be hanging in there, and I try to make sure that I've got plenty of food out each day. With a bit of luck, he just might have a good story to tell his friends and relatives when they get back in another 3 months or so. Not long ago, I had a mother in Dillingham stop me and ask about moose antlers. Specifically, her young daughter had wondered why moose grow antlers. Her daughter, whom I'm guessing I have met during classroom visits, was sure I would know. When I was asked by the mom, I was actually fairly under the weather, and I'm not sure my mind was in the right place. I tried to view and answer that question, why do moose have antlers, through the lens of how a younger child might want to know and ask, as in, Why do they even have antlers in the first place? I kind of chuckled and suggested only God knows the answer to that question, which wasn't as glib as it might sound given what I believe. A day later, however, it occurred to me that maybe I should have went a little deeper and given an answer for how they grow each year, which still doesn't account for any sort of deeper reason for why moose have antlers in the first place, but does spell out how they come back each year. The short answer is that antlers grow because of photoperiodism. That is, the amount of daylight triggers hormonal changes in the bull, causing a spike in testosterone production, which causes new antler tissue to begin to develop. And once things start, the floodgates really open up. Moose antlers are the fastest growing tissue in any mammal on Earth. At their peak, antlers can grow an inch a day and add over a pound of mass each day. When things slow to an end in the fall, a big bull can have antlers weighing 70 or 80 pounds. This same process occurs with all antlered animals, which around here also means caribou as well. In the fall, the process reverses itself. Testosterone production decreases, and the bond holding the antler to the skull at the pedicle weakens until the antler falls off. In hindsight, I could have provided that answer. I'll blame it on over-the-counter medication I was taking for why I was a bit addled that day and didn't consider other perspectives and answers. In mentioning caribou, I'd like to touch on something I mentioned a few weeks back, and that's the fact that you can't chase caribou with a snow machine. Not legally, anyway. There's a lot of folks who are having a lot of success with caribou right now, and that's a terrific thing. It's good to know that people are able to get meat for their freezer. I hunted down on the Nishigek Peninsula a few weeks ago myself, and on a couple of occasions, from a distance, my hunting buddies and I witnessed people with snow goes chasing herds while trying to shoot animals. Let me say it again. That's illegal. State and federal wildlife troopers will write citations for that every single time. Specifically, here is the language that addresses that as found in the Hunting Regulations booklet. You may not, and that's underscored and in bold all caps red in the booklet, take game by driving, harassing, or molesting animals with any motorized vehicle, such as aircraft, airboat, snow machine, or motorboat. You may not take game by a motor-driven boat or motorized land vehicle unless the motor has been shut off and progress has ceased. You may not take game by pursuing with a vehicle an animal that is fleeing. Again, that's verbatim language from the hunting regulations. And there's really not a lot that's ambiguous about it. It's pretty explicit. If you're chasing and shooting from a moving snow goat and didn't know, well, now you do. If you're chasing and shooting from a moving snow goat and you did know this, well, you might wind up putting meat in the freezer, but make no mistake, you're not hunting. And if you come across a wildlife officer while you're doing so, he or she will be happy to point it out. And on the subject of snow machines and travel, just a quick reminder to be as prepared as possible. I know that sounds kind of vague, but it can run the whole gamut from having enough oil and gas for the trip, to having enough clothes and extras to stay warm, to having oddball items like an extra hitch pin if you're towing a sled. If it's just a quick run to a friend's house, well, maybe it's no big deal. If you're traveling between villages or putting a lot of miles on your machine during a trip, it pays to have a few redundancies built into your planning. Take the time to prepare properly for longer trips afield. Pack the right tools, have extra parts and necessary items, like a tow strap, extra plugs, a spare belt, bottles of heat, whatever it takes, for your machine, and be sure you're prepared yourself. While the topics presented today may or may not have a lot of direct connection, the one connection should be abundantly clear. Whether it's related to your fishing gear, watching migratory birds, appreciating moose antlers, shooting a caribou, or riding a snow machine, there's a lot of terrific things to be done outdoors. So get outdoors and do them. Or put in the time on the crummy days preparing for when you'll be able. Oh, and one last thing in closing. Happy belated George Washington's birthday, which was celebrated this past Monday. Some of you call it President's Day, and that's fine, too. Officially, the federal government, my employer, still calls it Washington's birthday, and so I will, too. I have talked about Washington on past episodes, and if you want to either motivate yourself to do more with your life or feel bummed out about where your life is at, depending on how you're wired, take the time to read up a bit on our first commander-in-chief. It is humbling, in my opinion, to consider all that he did with his life and for what he saw as the betterment of others. So great was his influence globally, and so beyond reproach was his character, that when he died, England ran stories for days, praising his great character. Napoleon ordered France to observe a full 10 days of mourning, and people in the United States wore clothes of mourning for months afterwards. He was truly a leader who was beloved and respected by all. Of himself, Washington once said this, "I hope I shall possess firmness and virtue enough to maintain what I consider the most enviable of all titles, the character of an honest man." Wouldn't the world be a much, much better place if leaders today set that as their goal? In fact, we should all strive for such a mundane yet lofty goal. Okay, time to get down from my soapbox. For Field Notes, I'm Terry Fuller. Music from Loon Echo Lake provided courtesy of Solitudes at www.solitudes.com.